Hey, Caitlin.
Hey, Rebecca.
How are you?
I am good. I got my second vaccine last week and was immobile for days.
Ooh.
But
Moderna, Pfizer.
I got Pfizer. Okay. And I, you know, I'm the type of person that if I can be nauseous, I will be nauseous. So I expected it.
I mean, I can vouch for that.
Yeah, yes, you can. And other than I still have one lymph node in my neck that is so swollen still, even a week later. But other than that, I feel great. I'm a week away from being like completely vaccinated and I'm feeling so good.
Congratulations.
So good. Thank you.
You also have a family member who has expertise in this. Have they checked? Are you okay?
Oh, I'm fine. It's okay. Just my body is really fighting against everything, which means I should have a good response if I ever come in contact with it. So
that's awesome. I'm glad that your body is doing what bodies do and what vaccines help teach bodies
exactly.
to do.
How
I
are
also
you doing?
Had Pfizer. I did not have the lymph node thing, but apparently 18 hours in, according to my lovely wife, I turned a little green and didn't move off the couch for a few hours. I felt fine the next day. Yeah, so I've had the vaccine for a few weeks and learning what courteous new normal looks like now. Still kind of figuring out that social etiquette.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting to look back. I was thinking about how we've been making this podcast all through the pandemic, mm-hmm. and the seasons have changed, and like the COVID protocols have ebbed and flowed throughout the beginnings of each podcast episode, and it's like a weird little time capsule that we've created for ourselves.
Truth. Well, outside of that, I can mm-hmm. say that spring is finally here in Connecticut, but also I need to install our air conditioning unit this weekend because it went from freaking cold to I live in a 100-year-old house without central air and the second floor is just painfully hot because, you know, our world is on fire and we need to take best care of it in multiple ways beyond politics, like just environmentalism. We need to make some changes. So yeah, spring is running as fast as it can to get to summer. I guess spring is a hot girl summer season. I don't know. But yeah. How are the cicadas? Do we need to be worried about the...
The noise hasn't started yet, but they are out and about. And I delight in sending my dad and my brothers, who are all in locations in this country that will not get cicadas. So I delight in sending them pictures of all of the light poles where it's just like dotted with these disgusting little bugs. So they're here, they're out walking around like little lobsters on the sidewalk.
Should I send you the recipes that are on the Washington Post?
No,
for cooking them?
I've seen the recipes on the Washington Post. I've watched the videos. Everyone says that they kind of like taste like shrimp, and I'm not a seafood girl, so I think I'm set.
You constantly confuse people with your beach living, non-beach cuisine.
I know.
I grew up in a swamp. Seafood's part of like my like deep soul appreciation, so you know. But I don't love gator. So we each have stuff from home we don't
yeah.
dig. Anyway, making no sense. No, I can make this work. Speaking of food and books that have amazing recipes that do not involve really much seafood, but amazing spices. What are we discussing today?
All right. So, Rebecca, today we are discussing When Tara Met Farah by Tara Pammy, which is... How would we, I think in our notes and in our discussion off mic, we called this like a new adult kind of contemporary book.
Yeah, I would very much put this novella very close to novel in length, mm-hmm. Amazing story into the new adult category, being that the two MCs we follow, our two protagonists, fall between the ages of like 18 and 25. So they're in this position where they are, in theory, responsible for themselves according to the greater world, but also, you know, like many of us were or will be or are, if you're in that place, kind of dropped into this position of where you've been told what to do by other people around you. And then all of a sudden you're supposed to like have a copious amount of knowledge that you just walk into the world with. And none of us have that. So the messiness of figuring out yourself while living life for yourself, like that, that kind of new years to you phase of life.
So. Yeah. Who are the people in this book? Who's our little gems of MCs here?
We have the classic Grump and Sunshine energy between our two MCs, with a sunshining character who's going to have her own grump moments. We have Tara, who is the host of a web series called This Marsala Life, where she shares family recipes and goes through like her day to day. She is in a rut because she didn't pass her last math class in order to graduate high school, and she's recently come out. So like within the queer world, so a lot of stuff is going on with her internally, with like how she's being viewed by the people she cares about around her. She is also very doing that very new adult stereotype and very real thing for a lot of us of like living in a parental basement or attic, in this case a basement, while she kind of figures out what's going to happen next. Who's our second person?
Yeah, so we have Fura, who is a little bit older. She's 23, and she's grumpy, cynical, our globe-trotting math genius. She ends up at Tara's home because she is interning or working with Tara's mother, who is a math professor, kind of genius, and Tara notes a few times that Fura seems so self-assured and self-possessed, and she's unreadable, and she's just very, like, a straight shooter. She either says something to sometimes, like, disastrous effects, like she's not good at sugarcoating things, or if she knows that she doesn't have anything good to say, she just says nothing, so she's a little inscrutable. She's kind of escaping from her own life. Her mother has passed away, and her family, her extended family, is reaching out to her, both her relatives in India and her extended family, her father here in the States, who she's come to be closer to. But she's just kind of decided that, you know, she's ignoring them all. She's really dwelling in her own grief. And she's intrigued by Tara. They're sharing the basement in this home. And they have a quintessential, I don't know if I'd call it a meet cute, but they have the quintessential first meeting for a romance novel where they're both in various stages of undress. And there's a case of mistake, you know, Tara thinks that the shower and that the bathroom is empty, and Fura walks out of the shower and is just like dazzling and there.
Yeah, I think it speaks to the amount of communication that I would project onto one of our families more than the other about like a guest just being in the place where I reside, you reside, one of us resides, and that parent not forewarning that this was going to happen. So
yeah.
One thing that's really exciting about this book for me that you and I talk about all the time is hearing narratives that aren't the white Christian narrative of a Southern or an East Coast experience. This book involves two MCs who come from Indian influenced backgrounds, between Hindi and Muslim of faiths, or not practice faiths in some instances. But we have this, you know, very American story of influence of a culture that isn't necessarily European. And I was just super stoked to have that on the page. Besides, the writing is phenomenal. And I felt like it was my responsibility the few times I was confused to look it up, but I didn't feel like it was being talked down to.
Yeah. I mean, the story just felt so rich because at its heart, it's pretty simple. Tara needs to pass her math class in order to graduate from high school, and she feels just a ton of pressure to do so. And Fura realizes that Tara's in a dance group that has connections to her mom's, her deceased mother's favorite actress who's kind of gone off the grid. So in exchange for an introduction to this actress, she agrees to tutor Tara and help her pass her final math exam. So it's a very simple story, but the culture, like, and the just the rich characterizations of these two very different women makes it such a, like, just a fun read. It also shows the richness of these stories. So they share cultural heritage and similarities, but they're very different and see the world very differently. And they even clash in the beginning. They have a few misunderstandings because Tara thinks that Farah is, like, correcting her or insinuating that she's not Indian enough. And they have a funny shared moment, you know, where they're like, we're both speaking English because of colonizers, so let's just agree that it's a stupid language and we're both saying something right, which I just thought, it's just like depth and nuance that you don't get with every book.
The commonality within the book is the human shared experience. Yeah. The parts where I was reminded that this was not a voice that is mine to speak of was delightful, in the fact that it was just a vivid reminder of how incredibly rich and diverse cultures are, and how when I see myself represented over and over again, I'm missing out on, like, some of the most amazing things I could probably ingest as a human being. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's good to have those reminders and to intentionally seek out not seeing yourself on the page. You're yeah. a more empathetic reader and a better person for doing it. And these two women are just delightful. It's just, yeah. I want to start a little bit, because I feel the moments that, like, I had to really, like, realize where I was in the book was due to the fact that these two women felt like they belonged in the age groups that they were assigned. Mm. So often we read books that focus on mid to late 20-somethings, early 30-somethings, sometimes written by people who are not in that age category, and it's like a caricature of what a lived experience is like on the page, or what it could look like with the most contemporary examples. This felt like it is very, very, very current. It is very much the voices of people of those ages, 19 and 23, I believe, of the moment. And that when it ages, it will feel old in certain ways. But I think that is what made this particular experience in reading these women completely ingestible mm-hmm. for me. Like, it feels like a real way to honor the language that I hear so many people younger than me, my sister-in-law, is using, while also, like, letting it be a unique experience onto them and not trying to create, like, the idea of what it means to be a person in these younger ages. How was it in like reading a book where you knew the characters were younger? So it would, I think what I'm trying to ask Messi is, so often I hear people erase younger people falling in love with, like, oh, it's going to be your first love, or you'll get over this, or it'll mm-hmm. change. Mm-hmm. So we do have kind of a quick, fast love in this, and we get our happily ever after. Spoiler. But, you know, we read romance for a reason. I didn't find cynicism in these two getting together. I was definitely here for it. I was rooting for them the whole time. It allowed me to get out of my head of trying to prove they can make it and just enjoy the journey they were on. How was that for you?
Yeah, I feel the same way. And what I liked the most about this narrative was that the pressures that that they felt in their relationship weren't from some, like, business deal or, like, a business arrangement or, you know, like, a town contest coming, you know, like, name a plot. But that the pressure and sort of the challenges that they were each facing were really coming from within, and coming from, you know, just the mess of being in your 20s and trying to figure out your life. And I think that's the biggest reason why relationships ebb and flow, and, like, why we get together with people, is because we're trying, you know, relationships help us frame our lives in that way. So I really felt, like, here for them. I loved them. I do really enjoy a believable Sunshine character. I like that Tara had, you know, she had this outward presence that was really like shiny, for lack of a better word, but she had her own like darkness and her own demons that she was dealing with, and you really felt like she was working through them because of the relationship and because of what she was going through in the book. But I also think, you know, it wasn't a like end all be all. Like I believe that she's a strong enough character and person, no matter what.
Yeah. I want to go a little bit more into what you were saying just a second ago about this idea of like the internal. I think something that we were talking about off air that I'd like to bring back up is you pointed out when we were checking in right before we hit record about this idea that if it's not a white narrative, the family is going to be anti-queer. Yeah. Can you go into that a little bit more, and then I'll ask you a question after?
Sure. So in this book, we have two characters. Tara is a lesbian. She has come out to her family, and there is homophobia off the page. Like we do hear that not everyone in her family, in her extended family, reacted well, but her parents are very, very supportive, and it seems like she has a good support system. And Furrah is bisexual, and we don't get the sense that she's hiding that side of herself, or that that's something that she's like really grappling with. It does seem like her ex-boyfriend had a lot of thoughts about it, and she dumped him for a reason. But it was just, we've talked before on this podcast about how some writers do tend to write cultures that are not white as unsupportive of the LGBTQ members of their families. And it sort of on the page, it gets boiled down to like, oh, it's culture, or it's a generational thing. Meanwhile, we have a plethora of like very supportive cookie baking white grandmas. And it's just really nice that we didn't see that here.
No, we have amazing familial members and recipes, which are really important to certain plot devices. But yes, the queer was not the trauma in this. So what I want to take with that off of what you said earlier with it being internal and being that, you know, the queer is not the traumatic necessarily, is like jumping to the end, you know, like, of course, things get resolved. But one of the big issues we get with Tara is her identity as this disaster lesbian and what her family thinks of her based on how her academics went and the trouble she's having with certain things as well as coming out, and what she is projecting onto how the more seasoned adults around her feel about her as a young new adult. And we find out through the course of the novel and by the end of the novel, so much of what she had internalized was projection due to the own the restraint she put on herself and how she felt her family felt she should perform. I mean, her mom is a badass. There's no other way to say it. Her dad took on a role so often, you know, prescribed to women by being the person who was predominantly at home, while her mother, you know, pursued more of her career goals, and they were able to work out their relationship that way. So I think it's really, I think it takes a mighty hand with the pen to tell a story where we don't feel deceived when we learn that a character has internalized things and instead feel empathetic for the character's growth when they come to terms with the fact that everybody around them is constantly trying to grow and evolve at the same time. Mm-hmm. And we do a disservice to ourselves and to people around us when we forget that we are separate entities. But I'm horribly guilty of this. You know, I internalize a lot of guilt or joy or movement based on what I think other people are going to react to without always checking in with those people.
Yeah.
So this was written in such a way that it was, I really like, this is a book I want to give my younger sister-in-laws and a lot of like younger writers that I work with, and younger just being younger than me in my mid-30s, because I think there's a certain amount of empathy that these characters have that is the kindest and most gentlest reminder that you can be kind to yourself and still be a disaster lesbian, as Tara Sloth says. Also, I think most people are disaster queers when they first come out. And if they're not, then like they came out to themselves long before they shared it with somebody else. I can't name a single person in our life who did not implode when they dealt with their sexuality. I don't know if you can, but no, it works for me.
Yeah.
Also, the bisexuality is not a plot point in this book. And so often I feel that bisexual characters stop being bisexual as soon as a woman's involved here. I didn't feel that way at all. Like, I'm like, this is part of who she is. Awesome. And it's just happening that like the person she falls in love with happens to use feminine pronouns, identify as female, yada yada. So let's get a little messy before we get into like the sexy stuff. I don't want to talk about moms after sex, but let's talk about moms.
That's fair.
Okay. Don't have therapy this week. Don't have time to unpack this. So talking about parents now, we have Tara's mom, who is this math genius, and Tara believes is like feeling like not as proud of her as she could. Then you have Farah's mom, who has passed and was raising her mostly as a single mother, who busted her ass, owned a bookstore, made stuff happen, and was constantly pushing to I don't have the exact quote, but like to be more than she was. Like, I am giving, she expressed like, you are having opportunities, so you don't have to settle for what I'm doing. And there's an interesting pressure, I think, between these two women of the idea of how you measure yourself up based on the strongest woman in the room with you, without those women necessarily asking them what they want, but like prescribing what they think their daughter should do next. And Caitlin, as a fellow cis woman with a mother, was this a universal plot point for you, or was this unique to these women?
I would not say that this is unique to these women. I think there is, there's nothing like being a woman, a cis woman in a world with a strong mother who has expectations of you. Let's just say that.
I'll just leave it at that.
I thought this was so interesting that both of them were unpacking relationships with their mothers and thinking about like what is expected of them. And Tara's mom at a certain point towards the end, they have a conversation where Tara says, like, I thought that you were disappointed in me and I wanted to like pass this exam and graduate high school and go to college that you would be proud of me. And her mom is like, oh, why did you think that I wanted you to like be within the system of, you know, capitalism and X, Y, and Z. And like, did I make that happen? And it's just such a good reminder of like, I think as children, take in so much of our parents' expectations and like worldview, and a big part of becoming an adult. Again, this is a character who's 19, is like figuring out like it's okay to have a different plan for yourself than your parents, and also like your parents' worldview and ideas of like their lives and their world is changing just as much as yours is. At any moment.
And the permission that as two millennials, the idea of what jobs look like to our parents is not something you and I have ever experienced in our life.
I
think kind of going off of these expectations and taking a moment to look at like markers of intelligence, I think when you're looking at the two women, it's easier to point a little bit to like as a stereotypical intelligent woman because of her drive and her uni experience and her mathematics stuff. But like, really, she expresses like, I would have been happy. I wanted to be in the bookstore. That was happiness to me. Like this consistent thing of doing the same thing day in and day out with something that was evolving and growing onto itself, being the books, says a lot about like where we put markers for what we think is worthy work.
Yeah.
But on the flip, we have Tara, and I know that you've been diving deep into this, so can we talk a minute about like how hard it is actually to be a person who grows a vlog and thrives?
Yeah. So she is the host. She has a channel on YouTube called This Marsala Life, and she has 90,000 followers, which is like no small amount of followers. That's a pretty decent chunk of people. And she, you know, I've the pandemic has really introduced me to vlogging and vloggers, and the idea of her channel, she starts it when she's much younger, I would say in her teens, and her grandmother is there and they're cooking family recipes together and talking about their culture. And later after her, after she's doing it by herself because her grandmother passes, she's cooking these foods and, you know, sort of creating her own recipes. She says she kind of cooks from her heart, and she's thinking really critically about like where food comes from, like this family does this and this family does this, and how history and culture is literally baked into the food that we eat. It's just amazing. And a channel like hers would be so cool. My algorithm on YouTube is so young, straight, and white right now. I need to like, this was like a good kick in the butt to like find some better content to watch.
Did you stop watching K-pop? Like,
I mean, I'm always watching K-pop.
Okay, because I've seen what you've done to my algorithm when we're in the same space. My algorithm is also mostly straight white men. So like, I don't know, because that's who does history vlogs, sadly, most of the time. Okay, so a few things. One, in order to get a monetization navigation through YouTube, it used to be 1,000 subscribers with, I think, 4,000 hours of viewed footage or something. I don't know what the current numbers are, but she's definitely above that. And at that point can like get specific like sponsorships. I think, speaking of history and the love for that, the genius idea of not only offering like your family recipes, which really is a family's history book and a family scrapbook at the end of the day, like telling the story of who you are as a collective person, like group of people choosing to stay together. India is richly diverse, super huge, and has unique flavors everywhere around. So the idea of like merging those stories in an area not as familiar to maybe American viewers on an American platform with that type of monetization, and what that could do to open it, as well as like, just this book made me hungry. Yeah. We'll get to the thirsty in a minute, but it made me hungry. The biryani, it was hard. Like reading this book at 2 a.m. or midnight when I'm eating, like, it's not helpful, because like all you want to do is like call, like, here, best Indian food is by a restaurant that goes by the name Paradise. Like, you just, it's just a delicious book. But going from food to getting a little bit thirsty, is that what the kids say? I'm old, I don't know. I think it's I've heard my wife say thirsty before, and I like actually brought her water. I messed that up. sorry, babe. This book opens with like declaration of horniness, like sex is on the page from like sentence
from the first one. Sentence.
I think the first sex act is on like chapter 8. So going from our books where we're holding out for chapter 13 and sometimes in a Radcliffe novel like chapter 23, how did you feel having it? It felt like younger people who didn't have time to waste.
It really did. And like, so much of their initial attraction to each other was physical. You know, there's a lot of writing in this book about like each other's bodies and just how
good
they look.
And they're not completely buff and thin. There are curves. Yeah. There are curves and embraced curves. There are curves that are like slapped and squeezed and loved. Like, just yes, do it.
Yeah.
Get it.
And this just reminded, I mean, the first sex scene in this book just reminded me of being in college and like the buildup, you know, the week of buildup, and you like are dancing at a party and then you like can't help it and you just have to get off and like get off together. And I liked the fact that they had to navigate like Tara gets touched immediately, is really open about masturbating, like, in, you know, enjoys touching herself during moments with Furrow, which I think is exciting. We should see more of in books. And it wasn't like perfect sex. It wasn't the most mind-blowing thing ever. It wasn't like the best thing either of them have had.
They didn't fit like two puzzle pieces perfectly aligned. It was messy.
It was messy. It's a little scandalous. There's like, you know, going down on each other when the parents are like two floors above you.
Yes, just all of this is yes. The messiness also included, like, is that working for you? No, but if you let me do this to myself while you do that, like, I'm really aware when we see something else written in a sex scene, when how often we don't see it. Yeah. And I do feel that in reading so many of these, newer novels are including consent language in a different way than some of the older novels, older being like a decade, maybe, mm-hmm. if not like 5 years. Mm-hmm. But I feel that we rarely see women who are like, this is sexy, and me touching myself along with this will continue to make it like escalate even more. This pro self pleasure during the act of like joint pleasure.
Yeah.
Yes, people do that. And yes, like, knowing your body and what you want is super fucking hot. And also, it can get both of you out of your head. One can watch, the other can do a thing. Like, it's just, I'm glad that this has been demystified in this book for younger women to completely take control of their body and own it and be proud of what it can do for them sexually, mm-hmm. and just as a body that they're in every day. Yeah. Also, like you were saying a minute ago, masturbation is talked about very openly in this book, frequently. There's often talk about rubbing one out to alleviate some stress.
Yeah.
You know, certain things are very true, and that's one of them for some people. I also just really kind of appreciate how they're not great at sex. Like, yeah. It's not even like with each other. They're figuring out themselves, and the amount of research they do. I definitely laughed out loud numerous times in this book. It was funny. It was kind. It was inclusive. I also just like kind of lost my shit at the Kama Sutra-esque discussion of the,
I know I would say the third, maybe, like, true yeah. sex scene of the book. They are reunited after having to spend some time apart for the holidays, and they have a private room. You know, they're not in the basement of Tara's family home, and Tara has spread on the bed, like, all kinds of different sex toys because she's like, I looked up, you know, somebody once told me that I didn't look like a lesbian and that I got nervous that I wasn't going to be a good lesbian. So I looked up what lesbian sex was, and that made me feel worse. So instead of, like, at a certain point, I just bought all these sex toys so that I would just know what to do. And she also has this, like, notebook with drawings that she, you know, like, trying to figure out, like, what are all these different positions, like, how does this feel good? And she's so at the, you know, it takes a lot of guts to, like, present your new partner with, like, a bed just covered in different, very expensive sex toys.
And these aren't, like, Larry Flint Hustler strip club cheap crap tchotchkes. Mm-mm. These are, like, invested glass, high neoprene. Like, there is some stuff that, like, is an investment piece on that bed.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And she's on the one hand, like, confident because she's excited to finally be at this point with somebody that she really likes and who makes her feel good. But she's also like, I have no idea what I'm doing.
Yeah.
like, is this working? What?
I mean, I'm not going to put either of us on the spot to be like, so how was the first time that you tried to incorporate this into your uh-huh. life? We know a couple of each other's own funny stories. I have a roommate story of them buying something they thought was one thing and it turned out to be something else. And, like, being on the other side of the wall as they figured that out, you know, talk to me one-on-one. I will share the story, not in a recording. But, you know, how glorious to be a reader to like see this interaction and this conversation and not feel alone in that. I was really sitting in, I'm currently like in my marriage, we're both very open to research. And we've talked about this on a past episode. Would we take a sex confidence class and whatever? And you said, no, please don't gift it to me for my birthday. We said, don't worry. And I had expressed like, yeah, 100%. My wife and I would totally be down for doing that. No pun intended, but maybe, you know, whatever. But I do remember when I was like coming to terms with my sexual orientation and my attraction to women, and between internet and and what was available to me, like the few of us on my undergraduate college campus were like all passing around a copy of the Complete Lesbian Sex book. I'm not sure if you're familiar with this book, but it was like what all of us read back in the day. So I don't know if you have like anything you feel confident or comfortable sharing of like what the experience is like of trying to be a partner before you're a partner by doing your research. But this scene rang really true to me, the way too intimidating and the overcompensating, hoping something works. So,
yeah, I wasn't a researcher, but I was reading reading really adult stuff. Like in middle school, you know, like they didn't know what to do with me.
Mine was hetero presenting, whatever.
I mean, mine was pretty hetero, but I was also reading a lot of fanfic that was like very smutty and very gay. And every time I talk about fanfic, I unlock different fandoms that I read, which are more and more embarrassing. So I never felt nervous that like I never felt like drawn to research in the same way that you were, but I think that's also because I just avoided thinking about sex for so long because I was just like, I'm totally straight, like it's fine that I don't want to have sex with a man. Once I meet one that I like, I'll want to have sex with a man. And it's fine that I'm having sex dreams about women. Like, that's fine. So by the time that I had finally, like, come out to myself and realized that, like, oh, you could just have sex with a woman, I wasn't worried about it. Like, I kind of just figured I'd be good at it.
So there's the line, right? And one is 0 degrees and one is 180. I'm the exact opposite. I was so determined to know, like, how to do it well, that when it, like, if it went well and it didn't work, I could be like, okay, I'm not gay. I just had, like, weird sexual fantasies that I needed to fulfill. And then what happened was it was super awkward and I wanted to do it again. And I was like, oh, shit, it must be the woman, not the fan, I don't know. But no, I was like over researching to the point that we're not on a recording. We'll talk later.
We'll talk later.
In this scene, in most of these scenes, in all of these scenes, there's consent forward language.
Yeah.
To the point that like if Tumblr and TikTok had a perfect book baby, it would probably be this amount of consent language. Mm-hmm. Worked for you, kicked you out, made you very aware of the difference of our age.
Thoughts? I mean, I definitely feel like we've talked before about sort of like generations of romance. And I think this is of a certain generation of romance that demands, isn't the right word, but like wants to see this type of consent language and like see these conversations. It didn't kick me out because it actually fit with especially the character of Tara. Like she was such a little, she definitely had like a little Cancer moon or something in her. She was like such a little anxious person. Once you peel back the sunshine layers, like she was so sensitive and so much of her exploration of her, of like becoming, like having sex was saying like, oh, did you not like that because of me? Did you like what's going on? Like, tell me what's up. And so the consensual, like the language of consent came from those conversations, which felt very real. It didn't feel like a textbook. And I think this was just a masterful way to like be very clear, especially because they don't perform the same, at first, they don't perform the same sex acts on each other. Like, their first two sexual encounters, Fura doesn't get touched and is pretty clear about that. And I thought that was also just, like, good to see in a book, like...
And so true to some people's life experience. Yeah, I don't want to go too deep into it. Like, we've like worked around it sometimes, but I was briefly in a relationship with somebody at one point where she expressed like which act she finds to be more intimate, like her performing oral sex on somebody or having it performed on her. And I had never really thought about it prior to her at that time. And this is my early 20s. And it worked well for us because the thing each of us found to be more intimate was opposite of what the other person did. So like for our our fun times before we dealt with other stuff, it worked out really well. But I think, you know, there is a stigma put on. So often in these books, there's like a butch femme dichotomy. So there's like a stigma already there because of that.
Yeah.
So to, again, to read a book, if I was like a younger person seeing this portrayed in such a way where it wasn't stigmatized, would have been so freaking powerful for me. The consent language only would have kicked me out if I read it like as me saying it, because sounding that confident at some of those moments is like not something I'll lead forward with. Like, thankfully people find me cute and awkward every once in a while, you know, but like I this very much felt like it was consent as like almost foreplay or arousal. Like, this will get hotter and be more. And it worked in that way. And I think, you know, a lot of that for me too is, it's not hearing it as like a new thing to be introduced instead of as a thing expected going forward with that.
Yeah.
And how awesome if that is happening for people right now to not only have that permission, but have that expectation of the person that they're engaging with. Like, just that's badass. Like, kudos. Yeah,
definitely. Definitely.
We are running short on time. There is like the Bollywood moment. And the book has, you know, this subtitle because it's within this Bollywood series where we get to watch Fura meet her mom's idol, this actress who left India and is now living on the Pacific coast and has a life outside of like this amazing grand actress life that she had had before. It led me for a moment to pause and like even think like about our friendship and like the people we share in our life, about what the idea would be like to meet somebody or engage with somebody that somebody in our life really loves or cares about. Like if I was in a place. So like if you randomly ran into Stephen Sondheim one day, like I would be living vicariously through you indefinitely. Right. Like we all have those people. And I wondered, when you got to this scene, like, did it resonate with you in any way? Did it feel like a convenient plot device? Did it hold stronger weight? What was like the navigation of for you to watch these two in a moment where the vulnerability came from? So in this moment, the vulnerability is in watching the person that you're falling for live vicariously through somebody else to connect to somebody who's important to them.
Yeah, I thought these were really beautiful scenes because at its core, it was like, you know, what is it like to fall for someone and to like be here for someone who is grieving this tremendous loss that, you know, I think grief and loss of a parent for a lot of people is utterly transformative. And I really felt like this was a beautiful way to sort of remove the plot of the book from the like physical sexy aspects. And because this is a relationship that happens really quickly and it moves pretty quickly, this was a way that I felt like you just see this human connection in a lot of different ways. It was really beautifully done. And it made me realize that, like, I don't know who in some of the people, like, some of my most important people in my life, like, I don't know who their celebrity would be. And now I need to figure it out just in case.
Yeah, I was actively thinking about my immediate family, and I have no freaking idea. Like,
yeah.
But even if not like celebrity, just like somebody they admire who's living. I think so often about like the people we admire who have since passed, you know. Mm-hmm. But like what you would do if that energy was still here when somebody you cared about wasn't.
Yeah.
With all of this that we've talked about, and then tying back to the beginning and our wonderful horny food vlogger who eventually, you know, takes this small thing that she's built that isn't that small and decides to pursue it in business forward ways and things like that. I'm on a lot of book talk. I'm on a lot of Bookstagram.
Yeah.
These are things that fill my life. Why the hell is this book like not all over social media that way? Because like when you see a checklist of what people say they want, which is more voices of color, written by a woman, body positivity, sex positive, masturbation positive, consent positive, dealing with parents without emotional and mental abuse, it hits like every check mark, but I haven't seen the book pop up anywhere. Have you? Like, I feel like the algorithms are broken. Something's not right.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I have seen this, but definitely not as much as I thought I would. Like, I'm like you. I'm on a lot of Bookstagram, book talk, following a lot of authors. And I think it just makes you realize how easy it is for a book to be, like, for, you know, it just makes you think about those algorithms, and it makes you think about what you're seeing on social media. And, you know, I think Bookstagram and social media is a great way to like connect with authors and find new things, but also reminding us all to be really cognizant of like what's missing. Like, there are great books like this that I just wasn't aware of until somebody, I think a friend of mine, I know a friend of mine read this and mentioned it to me. So yeah, let's get this, let's get this more on Bookstagram.
I think you make a solid point about the algorithms casing to whom they think can get the most views, and mm-hmm. due to white forward voices already ruining algorithm counts and things like that, because algorithms are conditioned to follow white voices in America. I think another thing too to point out here, and we're seeing this like talked about in a bigger sphere regularly right now, is the difference between being lifted up when you're within a group of like people under the same umbrella head, such as publishers or, you know, corners of Bookstagram, Twitter, book talk, and then what it's like when you put out something without that rallying call, or even if it has it, how fast it can die out. I'm just very aware that, you know, something being on Twitter pretty strongly, but not being written up, let's even say by like Autostraddle or, you know, BuzzFeed or other places we get these listicles from, how that kind of feeds into everything. So I've been kind of like really sitting in, I have a really love-hate relationship with Goodreads. I do like to go to Goodreads to learn about stuff I didn't know about. I really kind of despise Goodreads rating systems because it gives a lot of power. It gives a lot of power to reviewers of books that don't have as many reviewers. Your review will carry much more weight on that particular book, and which means negative reviews can destroy a book because there's just not as many people reviewing. Mm-hmm. So I navigate that very with a lot of difficulty. Full disclosure, when we started doing this, I deleted my Goodreads account. I do not publicly share my opinions about books because we have an agreement only to lift up the idea of this genre as much as we can. But I'm really just sitting in where my responsibility is outside of this podcast, besides in my reading activity, to do something and what energy I put in to try to like mess up this heteronormative, mostly white men, but mostly white, or, you know, pop culture inclusive narrative structure, and to get books like this to show up more places. Because I feel that when people are talking about what they're looking for, this hit so many buttons when you brought it to me, and I was like, yeah, let's do it, let's read it. And then I was just really kind of bamboozled with how few people had ever heard of it. Yeah. So I don't know why I put my weight on myself. We're doing this pod. We're both super busy in real life. But if anybody out there has better ways to be an active participant without leaving a review, let me know. And me choosing not to leave reviews is because you and I do this podcast together, and I would never intentionally do anything to reflect upon you without your full consent. So that's why I don't engage. But yeah, I really want to blow some of this up. I want to change the narrative some. And I'm saying this as a white woman sitting across from another white woman, but like, yeah, we're still queer and we're very different types of queer. And I want more of our stories out there and want more accessibility and want people to find them sooner.
Yeah. So. We just need to start the LLC that we've been dancing around for the past several years.
Look, I'm going to put this on recording. You tell me in a moment at the end of this, I can keep it, but I'm looking forward to what's going to happen with same sex. I've heard some rumors about things that may happen with same sex. I am ready to freaking produce it, bring it. Let's get it done. Also, this podcast has me on it, but we both know the intention was to focus on you. So anything you want to do, that's not me. Let's get the LLC going, and I will happily edit and produce, and we'll create more Twilight theme music for your stuff. So like,
all of this is to say that my goal in life is to have as many followers on something as Tara does, so that we can have our own little company that uplifts queer narratives and queer voices.
And how many visitors does your homegrown mom and pop style art blog currently have on Instagram?
Not as many as this great food blog.
But how many?
Who's to say?
You know exactly how many. But anyway, homegrown, no advertising. You're killing it there, and we could take it to another level. Tell me what you want.
Rebecca, if people want to tell you Goodreads alternatives or just sort of anything else, we're always looking for book recommendations. So like, hit us up. Where can people reach you? How can people find you?
I'm at Rebecca Writes a Romance on Instagram or Rebecca ATTT Pod on Twitter. We are at A Tip of the Tongue on both Instagram. Nope. On Twitter, we're at ATTT Pod. So yep. No, we're at A Tip of the Tongue on Instagram and ATTT Pod on Twitter. Caitlin, if people want to check out your art blog, they go to
Same Sex in the City on Instagram. And if you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm Same Sex the City.
And wait, we did this a little backwards. Are you really watching or doing anything this week?
You go first.
I go first. I am listening to a whole bunch of NPR podcasts that I'm behind on, especially things like Hidden Brain. And I have been reading more nonfiction lately. It's kind of just what I want to do in the hammock. I am looking for recommendations for our Summer Solstice Erotica episode. Mm-hmm. I might put something on Twitter before this episode goes live. Let's see if we can get some bites. We'll see what happens. And I'm doing like going through the notes and reading an upcoming author and getting stuff ready for June. We've got some stuff on the docket that requires some extra time. So that's what I'm doing. What are you doing?
Yeah, well, besides getting my ass in gear and reading everything that we have on the docket for this podcast coming up, which is exciting. Like June is going to be a really exciting month for the podcast. I haven't been reading very much, but I have been listening to a ton of podcasts. And I'm here with another totally random podcast recommendation. It's called I Love a Lifetime Movie. And it's two comedians who recap a different Lifetime movie every week. It's hilarious and so weird. I love it. I love it. I love it so much.
Well, I think you just got a second message from somebody who we both know who randomly found the pod and wants to talk to you about it. So that's the weird life of podcasters, y'all, is when people in real life find you organically. So I think we should stop here and check in about that and get ready for the episodes coming in June. How do you feel?
Feeling good.
All right. you should still water your plants behind you.